You're listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis.
Okay, welcome back.
Hello, everyone.
We have not been here yet.
No, so welcome to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. You may notice that Joby's not sitting here next to me tonight.
I'm not tall enough to be Joby.
Well, nobody is. Wait, is that right? I don't know how that goes. Anyway,
what did he tell us that we were supposed to read?
Let me get the paper out. Yeah. I am sorry I cannot be here this evening. I am held away at business. So he's got glycol issues. And for anyone who
can't take a prescription for that.
No, I think that is a prescription, isn't it?
I think so.
So glycol is the stuff that keeps everything cold in a brewery. And it's running through the lines to make sure that when you pull the tap handle, that the beer is coming out, is cold. And
otherwise you have an unintentional cask pour.
So either it's freezing everything or it's not keeping things cold enough. I think I'm going to err on the side to say that it's pouring way too cold.
You think so?
No?
I was thinking too warm, like maybe the glycol system wasn't pumping through, like wasn't circulating properly. But I'm actually intrigued by glycol issues that have your beer too cold. Maybe he's almost got like a little icy.
Beer ices.
Yeah. Nice.
No, you're probably right. What's happening is, if it's not keeping it cold enough, then everything that comes out of that tap out of all 101 taps would be foam if they're not going to be cold enough. And what's nice about, like, especially where he's at, they've got trunks, and there might be 10 or 15 beer lines through there, one big glycol line.
Right.
And so hopefully it's not all of them.
Those things are massive, too. When I was working, my last corporate job, we were in and out of casinos and restaurant openings all the time with our software. The trunks that ran in the casinos were looked like they should have been on the Golden Gate Bridge. They were huge bundles, and they sometimes would run multiple floors or through multiple, hundreds of feet to get to where they needed to be, from the pump room down to the taps and the bars. It was amazing, these pump systems and the number of lines and amount of lines they had to run.
What kind of fabulous beer were they running through those lines?
It was fabulous. If you want to hear more about it, you can go to our other show, Pints and Pairings, and the Bud Malures Challenge.
Listen to the Bud Malures Challenge. Yeah, that's what I was guessing, that it's probably
a lot of domestics. I mean, there's probably some decent beers. Some of the casinos have more high-end bars. And with the craft beer scene the way it is right now, I'm sure they're trying to bring in some local stuff and some better product. But, yeah, just bundles and bundles of hose running all through the casino, delivering somebody's delicious goodness to their glass.
Probably in one of those giant yard things that you hang around your neck and you walk around the strip.
That's a whole other show. We got a much better, more refined and sophisticated topic for tonight.
That's right. We are on location, I should say. Not at Barrel House like we usually are. Barrel House 101. We are actually at the Four Bricks tasting room here, Four Bricks Winery in Ventura, California.
We've got kind of VIP treatment because the tasting room is not open on Thursdays typically, and there is no one in here. So we've got the winemaker, Gary Stewart, to ourselves. No distractions.
I know, it's fabulous. He's opened some wine. He's given us a taste here. This is right out of the... Gary, how about you pick up your microphone real quick? I got to ask you a question.
Sure.
Is that a fermentation tank that it came out of?
Yeah, it's under fermentation. It's been in that tank for just about a month now.
So it's a little sparkly still.
It looks like grapefruit juice.
It does. And for me, it actually has a really refreshing grapefruit finish. I'm sorry, did you say what it was? I think you told me earlier, but did you just say?
It's Viognier.
Viognier. So just a wonderful treat to be able to taste these. And this is one of the things that I was so excited about this evening, too, is I've tasted beer at all of the stages and multiple times at all those stages just through home brewing experience, but I've never had the opportunity to taste wine at these different stages.
This is definitely, I think Gary referenced earlier, kind of for the beer lovers, right? Because if it's such an early stage of fermentation, there's some cool stuff going on. There's some carbonation involved. I get a little bit of coconut actually out of this, a sweetness to it that I, especially at such an unrefined state, that you're not going to get in a finished glass.
No, and it's very typical to have those tropical fruits with Viognier, so it's great that you picked up on that, and you usually do, Jason. You have the palate, that's for sure. One of the things, too, you're going to see with it is it's very cloudy, so it almost looks like a Hefeweizen or mm-hmm. a wheat beer, and that's because of the little tiny bubbles that are going on in there, and there's still yeast, so the yeast is still active, too.
A fermentation in my tummy.
Oh yeah,
I like it.
You'll feel it tomorrow.
Oh yeah, if not sooner. So we'll come back to Gary in a couple minutes and talk to and hit all of the great aspects about that. I'm so excited to look at all those. Before we get to there, though, I want to talk about something that's really.
I know you've got a bone to pick or something. You're
That's really exciting for us tomorrow. I'm already jumping up a day, but on Saturday we're going to be in Ojai, and we're hosting, emceeing, whatever you want to call it, the Ojai Beverage Company.
Yeah, I'm excited, but I'm a little anxious and skeptical because Joby asked us if we had any festive attire, aka lederhosen or some kind of hat or something. And so I'm not sure if it's going to be like a professional MC event for us. Our first MC gig together may, in fact, be at our own expense.
And I'm going to dress like it is supposed to be at our expense.
Well, let's not fib to the listeners right now. You're not going to dress like you're supposed to be. You're going to make your lederhosen.
Well, yeah, but I'm going to be wearing lederhosen. I mean, I'm going to work really hard on it. So I don't have any lederhosen, and I don't have the cash to go buy a nice pair. And I don't necessarily want to buy like a costume.
They can be expensive. I asked the guy today. I went to Brought Brothers down in Newbury Park, trying to do a little research, maybe prep for the Saturday morning show. And he had these sweet brown, like, suede leather pants with all the embroidery and stitching and everything involved. I was like, hey, where'd you get your pants? He goes, oh, the owner of Brought Brothers gave them to me. I'm like, oh, cool, where'd you get them? He's like, Munich.
Right.
Like, oh, well, I don't have time to go to Munich and get the real deal. So,
You're talking, you know, for the pants, the shirt, the suspenders, the socks, and the shoes.
It's an investment.
You could probably... For depending on how fancy you're looking at, even just a baseline would be a couple $100 for that setup, and then going as high as $500.
I'm sure
suede pants, suede shorts.
Yes, first of all, just saying suede shorts.
I would like to be wearing suede. I think
there's a whole subculture.
<I don't know.
laughs> But most of those, I have to imagine, are handmade. They're done with care and craft over in Bavaria and Germany.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I've been to Munich twice, and every time I go, it's one of those things where I see it and I say, I'm going to buy it. And then I go, no, I'm going to get it at the next place. And then I'm just going to keep window shopping. And then all of a sudden you're on the train and you're heading out of the city
and you don't have it.
And I go, okay, the next time I go. The next time I'm there, I'm not waiting. Generally, one of the things is Munich is like the first stop. You fly in.
Right.
And
it's
then
a major
that's,
hub.
Right. And so you've got two more weeks or three more weeks of carrying around lederhosen. No, those don't go over
just
very
wear
well.
Them,
in, they don't go they don't go over very well in France or in Belgium. You kind of want to piss off all the locals.
What's
you know?
Wrong with pulling a Clark Griswold? You just wear lederhosen from country to country.
I would love to wear it in the UK. Just walk around. Hey.
Wasn't that not a perfect scene, though, for him? When he gets into the dance and he doesn't really figure it out, and they end up breaking out in a fist fight. You know, he's trying to do the dance, but he's elbowing people, and they're getting into
It has been so long since I've seen it that I can't even pull that scene out of it, and I don't know if I've even seen it from start to finish once.
Look, kids, there's Big Ben.
I don't even know what that means, and it's funny to me. So anyway, we're gonna be. I'm making my suspenders and everything. It's going to be out of duct tape.
I've never seen duct tape lederhosen.
And I have got the best plan and the whole idea of making it. It's going to look sharp. It is. I just got to go. I got to stop at Home Depot tomorrow and pick up. You go walk by the bin and there's this giant bin full of 50 different.
Are you going to use some colored? Like, are you going to decorate?
Oh yeah.
I'm impressed. I thought you were just going to go straight.
Oh,
old
like gray.
No.
And then use a Sharpie and draw all
over
it. No. Well, there might be some Sharpie drawings on it, but it's going to have all kinds of designs in it too. Probably my hop cone, who knows.
I'm impressed.
But we'll see. And then, otherwise you're just wearing, you put the suspenders on, you get the little cod piece thing that hangs out here in front. And then you wear socks that come up to your knees, and then that's it. I mean, shorts and socks, that's lederhosen, right?
I'm on board with that.
That's the American version of Oktoberfest.
My wife's picking up a lederhosen costume for me this evening because she was out returning some other costumes that we were potentially going to wear next week for my birthday.
Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Yeah, so next week in town, there's a theater right actually not far from here at the Four Bricks. They have awesome Thursday night, what they call Insomniac Theater. And they're kind of their Halloween series right now. Ghostbusters was going to be playing next week. It's 2 days before my birthday. So she went out and bought inflatable Stay Puft Marshmallow Man and an inflatable Slimer. Because the original plan was we're going to start at Surf Brewery.
I think he can hear you, Ray.
Yeah.
Ugly little spud, isn't he? Okay, sorry, go ahead. No.
Good one. You stumped me out because all of a sudden I was transported right to the hallway.
There it is.
But she thought, we're going to start at Surf Brewery, wear these inflatable costumes with a bunch of our friends, and then walk over to the theater for the movie. Two other events are going on that night that I have gotten roped into. One I finally, we had to back out of, but we're going to be hosting a food share group at the Dinner at the Ranch for Totally Local VC, which is pretty cool. I was geared up, though. I was going to wear the costume anyway. I was debating on just being Stay Puft Marshmallow Man no matter what. She's like, no.
At the ranch.
She's like, let's return it and see what else they have.
That would have been fun.
So it worked out to my favor for the Lederhosen costume. But I need socks now. You've reminded me I'm going to need some kind of sock.
Yeah, you're going to need not sock, stocking.
Stocking, yeah.
Yeah, this you're gonna have to go find something.
I can find something because I'm also implementing Food Sock Friday, hashtag Food Sock Friday. So last week, 2 weeks ago, I did taco socks. I found at Target, and they've got like four or five other styles. So I'm on the hunt for obscure socks. I'm not too concerned.
And so because this is on Saturday, are you delaying Food Sock Friday?
No,
or are you going to go 2 days in a row?
That's what I'm saying. I'm going to hunt for both. I'm going to hunt for stockings at the same time as hunting for Food Sock Friday.
Oh, boy. I'm looking forward to this.
And if nothing else, I'll go to your method. I'll take some of my white athletic socks. I'll Sharpie and magic markers, some cool colored bands around the top, and call them stockings.
I think you've got a plan. I'm just going to actually duct tape all the way around my leg and draw.
You're going to end up looking like some of these guys I've seen on the internet, like the fraternity guys that pass out at the party and they duct tape them to the ceiling or to their couch.
Well, the one that I'm getting my
chest
design,
plate,
I guess, from is the guy actually did his shorts, but it looks like he taped himself into it. Like everything is taped. He had a shirt on. It looks like he taped everything into it. And he's, you know, like these nutter. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, that's not. Genevieve would not approve.
No. So anyway, so that's Saturday. Looking forward to it. That'll be a lot of fun. There's going to be a bratwurst eating contest. Carry your Stein contest. How many Steins can you carry? A dancing contest.
I have to carry your Steins is earlier in the day, though. That sounds like danger zone after a couple of Steins worth.
That could be. Did I say dancing already?
You did.
Costume.
Yeah, costume.
And then maybe one other one. I can't remember.
We're trying to come up with a mystery game for everybody. I know you mentioned that in your text, so we'll see what happens.
Let's see what it is. All right. I think we should just kind of leave that as is right there.
That's enough of that.
Go to a break. Come back. We're going to be talking with Gary Stewart.
We're going to try to take ourselves up a notch. Right. We're going to move into another echelon of beverage. So stay tuned.
We're going to come from the world of beer festivals and possibly the epitome of beer festival, Oktoberfest.
Yeah,
you know, whatever happens at O-Fest.
I had some awesome liverwurst at Brat Brothers today, which I don't normally eat, but it is Oktoberfest time. So
yeah,
but so we are going to try to move ourselves up a notch or two. You may not approve. We're going to do our best.
Sounds good. So we'll be back in just a few minutes. I'm going to finish this, and we'll rinse it out, and then we'll start with the wine tasting.
Let's do it.
This is Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis.
I'm Jason.
And Jason is sitting in for Joby tonight, so it is Happy Hour with
Curtis
and Jason tonight. And we'll catch you in a couple minutes.
And now, back to the show.
Life is good.
Life is good. That is
life is good with what we have in our glass.
That
too.
Is that was Nas. Do you know that?
I do know Nas.
Oh, okay. So, I'm
He's
old.
Got a cool
I'm,
sound.
I'm on the older side of the edge of that
we
cliff.
We can get you up and running. Don't worry, Curtis. Okay. We'll get you a new library. But with what we have in our glass right now.
Yes. Well, first of all, I want to welcome everyone back because now this time I am actually welcoming people back.
Yeah.
Forgetting that, wait, we haven't been talking yet. So really, I'm just welcoming you to the show.
The first time wasn't actually inappropriate because you were broadcasting last week. So you're welcoming them back this week. But the context threw me off.
Yeah, it was a little odd. So this is Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. And Jason is sitting in for Joby this evening. There's this a big restaurant emergency. And as you know, business owners have to do. They've got to tend to their business.
Front line.
So coming out and drinking with me on location just wasn't in the cards for him tonight. But luckily, I thought
pulling the roadie.
Well, first of all, a couple of days ago, I had asked Jason if he was going to be open, and he's more than welcome to come in because we're tasting wine, and Gary alluded to it a little earlier too, just about your palate, which is always nice to have around. So I want to start first of all with all these accolades recently for Brix Winery. The number one winery as voted by the readers of Ventura, Ventura County Reporter, and a nice little right here we go. We've got the magazine right here, VC Reporter, for all of us locals, and number one winery pick. Congratulations, Gary.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
It's something that I've known since I met you. I don't know. I mean, back in November, December, when last year was the first time that I had the pleasure
show
of meeting.
Show 2, I think.
It was show number 2 for Happy Hour, and we're back. Thank you so much for...
I was so successful on show 2, it took him a year to get back to me.
Well,
you kind of set the bar for all the other guests. Yeah,
That's the problem. Right. We've got to make sure that we are improved when we come back to you, and so that there's some sort of... incentive for you to allow us to come back. And thank you too, because this was kind of a short notice. You know, we had a last minute cancellation, and I was commiserating with my wife because we were going to do Paradise Pantry and talk about some wine and cheeses.
I like you use commiserating.
Well, because I was just like, we'd been doing beer a lot, and you know, I love beer, but I was ready to go and try some other things. And she goes, and she went out on a run. She came back and she said, you know, it's grape harvest. And I'm thinking, through Facebook, I've seen Gary posting on going out and getting grapes and everything. And I thought, that's what I have to do. So I sent him a quick message, say, hey, can we come in? Yes, of course. And here we are.
And it's
tonight.
Great timing.
Wonderful.
Over the evolution, to have these awards and these accolades now with Ventura County is kind of cool for me, because I think I've known you guys, not obviously since you've been making wine, but almost 2 years at this point.
Oh,
I
yeah.
I met
yeah.
you guys initially through the Wild Game Dinner a while back, and been kind of inserting myself more and more, trying to understand the whole process of winemaking. So I'm doing harvest with you. I've done, you know, press and the crush and the
Jason's done it all. He's it's unbelievable.
Tastings. It's a really cool. It gives me a better appreciation for how wine gets in my glass. Just like, you know, as a brewer, you've gone through the process. You make it at home. You've tasted all the different phases. It was selfish. I'm not gonna lie. When I said, Gary, I want to get into the back room, because it was all about my own knowledge. It wasn't about helping you, but now it is about helping you because I have a better understanding of what you're doing. But initially, I just want to know what you're doing.
And what's really fun with that is we have what we call our crush crew, and Jason's a member of the crush crew. And it's so great now because I'll literally bring stuff in and they just go to it. I don't even have to say anything anymore. And I'm just watching these guys busily working away at it, and they know how to make wine.
Gary rolls up with the forklift. He's got a bin on it. He puts it in place. We're like, okay, go get the next one.
And so what exactly does the crush crew do?
They do everything, literally, from start to finish. So we'll call them up and have them come out to help us at any time. There's a group of us, women and men, and they get together. And pretty much throughout harvest, they're out here doing crush, press, and rack, and then they help out with bottling. They help out when we're moving barrels around throughout the year. They help out with tasting. And this year, we're going to get them more involved with the blends, working on blending the wine together. And we're really trying to get them out and to learn more about the wine process, too.
You ran through a couple terms, too, that we want to make sure people understand. So you talk about the crush, the press, the rack, the punch. Give us what those are.
So what I envision is Jason coming in his shorts and minus the stockings and his shoes.
No lederhosen.
And then putting his feet into it. Are we that primitive here, or are we, or
I'm not going to answer that, Gary.
No, we're,
as for the health code, no, we don't do that.
Actually, it's totally fine, and it happens a lot. Sure. But we just don't do it here. We don't like to have purple feet.
It's more ceremonial for a lot of wineries, though, isn't it?
It is.
Represents
it's cool.
The start of harvest.
And I can tell you, I've done it before, and I'm not saying it's the wine you're drinking right now, but I've done it before, because it is. It kind of gives you a sense of being at one with the grape. You know, it's an old craft. This is the way they did it back mm-hmm. when. And I had a winemaker tell me one time that you have to get in there and you have to feel it. And when I was squishing around in the grapes, you could really feel cold spots and warm spots within the bin.
Oh, sure.
And so you knew when you were in there, your feet told you, hey, I need to mix this area up more and I need to move this area into this area, you know, because the yeast were maybe just kind of hanging out in the corner and they weren't cultivating through. So there's something to be said for that.
But there are some wineries in Europe that are still doing that full process. They've got very strict sanitation rules that have to be followed, moving from bin to bin. I've watched a couple of documentaries. Mm-hmm. Would you ever entertain that idea, though, if someone said, we want to have a batch made strictly from kind of an old world perspective?
Yeah, yeah. I think it would be pretty cool. You see it a lot in the Portugal area still, where they're doing it in port, because in port it's a much quicker fermentation going through, so they're trying to extract as much as they can from the grape. And so you'll just see that I have videos of literally like 20 grown men just walking in these vats over and over and over again. Just
got to be a good workout.
Yeah. And the idea behind that for the beer people, that's how we extract color and flavor. It all comes from the skin itself. The juice, the vinifera wine grape, the European wine grape, the juice is predominantly clear. There are a few varietals that have red juice, but it's predominantly clear. So your red wine that we're going to be drinking here in just a minute, the juice, if we pressed it off right away, would have been clear. It would have been a clear wine. But we allow the skins to stay in contact with it, and we keep pushing the skins down into the juice to kind of tea. Well, I was going to say tea bag. I guess I could say that here on.
Yeah,
but you know,
it's
like
webcast.
But you know, just like using a tea bag and dipping it back and down into your tea, it's going to extract more than just letting it float on top of the tea.
And that process you're talking about, when you've got your feet and you're pushing through the grapes, extracting that color, that right now is called the punch, right?
So, yes, punch down.
So let's walk backward a little bit. The grapes come in a bin. They're half-ton bins.
Before we even get that far, though, so, I mean, because we're in an industrial part of Ventura, there's no vineyards around here.
You gotta get the grapes here, right?
Yeah, so where are the grapes coming from? And then, I when we were setting up this show, you said, I don't know if I'm going to be out on harvest. And so I have this vision of you getting this code blue call in the middle
phone.
Of the night, and then then having to go out, because now is the time. This is the exact moment when we need to pick these grapes. So kind of maybe go with us from that. So when do you
sure.
get the call to go get the grapes?
Well, harvest in the northern hemisphere takes place during the fall. Well, I guess it's fall down there too. I don't know how they refer to it down under, but it's during the fall months. So sometimes starting in August, but typically September, October, November is the time for harvest. Like you said, most of the grapes that we bring in this year, we actually have a grape coming in from Ventura County that we worked on.
Excellent.
But most of the grapes we bring in are from outside of Ventura County. So we're bringing in grapes from San Ynez, Paso Robles, and Sonoma. And this is the time of year that we envy beer makers all the time, because you guys can make beer whenever you want. You make beer with bread and cereal, essentially. So it's, I mean, that's what it is. And I'm just tossing one over. But you know, it's for the most part dried. It's a dried process. You guys are using stuffed grains and things that have been dried, and then you're bringing those back to liquid form and then making beer out of it. We have to make wine with fresh product. We can't go and dehydrate grapes and then try to reprocess them and bring them back. It doesn't work. It'd be really bad. It'd be really bad wine. So we only get to make wine once a year, and we only get one shot a year. So you guys might make 20, 30 lots of beer in a year. It'd take us our lifetime to do that. So we get one shot a year to make the best wine that we possibly can. And yes, Mother Nature controls all of it. She really does. So we, you know, winemakers at this time of year, we call ourselves the slave to the grape, because literally we're on call all the time. It's like waiting for your wife to give birth. It really
is. Because you do have some vineyards that are growing grapes specifically for your winery.
Yes.
is there like a big spotlight with an FB logo and they shine it up and like Gary, kind of like Batman, you know?
No,
how do you know? Like the
farmers are pretty sophisticated now. So what they're doing is they're posting online. Yeah, they do. But they post online. They have a little portal. They post online the sugar readings. So we'll start talking to them on the phone. Probably sometime in August, early August, we'll start talking to them on the phone, and then we'll start watching the sugar readings. So they'll keep posting the sugar readings, and we'll just, as the sugar readings are going up, we know that once it gets to a certain BRIC level, which is the measurement
of
sugar.
Your name comes from, right? The BRIC portion.
The sweetness of the grape, the degree BRIC. And once it gets to a certain level, we know that we're a couple of weeks out or a week out or a few weeks out, depending on. So typically you're picking anywhere from 22 to, you know, if you're really making an over-extracted crazy wine, maybe 28 bricks. And generally, it's about a brick a week during normal weather. So if you know you're going to pick that around 25 bricks, and bricks isn't the only thing that we pick it off of. You know, we're also looking for the development of the grape and the pH levels, the acid levels, and things like that. But the bricks are a really good indicator. We know that if it's we're going to pick at 25, it's at 23, we're a few weeks away. And then typically we'll get the call like I got today, and they'll say, hey, you know, we're picking next Thursday on the 10th. Make sure you're up here early in the morning, because they start picking these places at 2, 3 in the morning under light.
Why do they pick so early?
Well, they pick early, one, because it's still pretty hot here, you know, so it definitely helps out the picker. But really it's for us. It's for the winemaker. We're kind of spoiled. And when you bring in really cold fruit, it just helps with the process, which is the next piece that we'll talk about. So I'll go up and get the grapes, and I'll come back down. And when I get back down here, then I call up the crew. You guys come over, and we go through the first process, which is sorting and crush. And the crush itself, or the destemming, is why you want the grapes chilled, because they'll pop off the vine a little easier than just being kind of pulled off. If you've ever had like an a grape that's kind of warm, and you go to pull it off, and kind of the whole inside stay on it, yeah, and you end up with the skin
you're
in your hand.
You're basically
skinning it. Yeah, yeah. and so you just, like, you don't really want that. It's not good for a lot of reasons. So having the cold grape just helps process it a little better. It's spoiling us, really.
When your farmers are checking the sugar levels, are they checking it from the top and the bottom? They're checking it from the inside to the outside of the fields, I'm guessing, all those different areas? And
yeah, the good farmers will go through and take a sample of the entire area. So we might be picking from maybe 4 rows or 5 rows. They'll go through and take a sample all the way around, keep putting in bag. They'll smash the bag up to get it homogenized, and then they'll take the readings. And typically what they're looking at is the acid levels and the sugar levels on that.
Interesting.
So then the crew comes in, and I think we got to the point to where it goes into the bin. Are we to that point right now?
So they're brought in,
sure,
in the bin,
mm-hmm,
the half-ton bins, mm-hmm, and you're just kind of circulating those bins through the destemmer, right?
Exactly. Here, we're a small winery. You know, we're making a little less than probably 2,000 cases. So we kind of do things a small way, and we just reuse the bins that we pick into. We actually ferment into those. So they're half-ton bins, open-top fermentation, and that's what all of our reds go through. Some of the bigger wineries will do it in tank, and then they do something called a pump-over instead of punching it down, because, you know, if the tank is 10,000 gallons of wine or must, you can't push that down with a stick or sometimes even hydraulics hard to do. So they'll just literally take a pump and just pump it up and over to extract that flavor and color. And then they'll use a cooling jacket to keep that cool during the fermentation, because, as you know, with wine, with beer, heat is part of the process that comes off of it. And when you have that much grape together, the heat can get pretty crazy, and it could either kill the yeast or just add some funky tastes to the wine. So they'll actually use the glycol that you guys were talking about before and jacket a tank and chill it as it's going along to keep it at a nice fermentation temperatures. You know, yeast kind of like our temperatures, you know, 75 and sunny, you know, that's kind of what it likes.
So then this one right here, is the wine that we have, or the sample we have, is coming out of one of those half-ton bins, right?
Yeah, what I thought I'd do for you guys tonight, I was excited to have you here at the winery, first of all, but I thought I'd take you through kind of the whole process. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through Sangiovese for 2 years. We're going to drink 2 years worth of Sangiovese. This is Sangiovese that is literally it was just pressed. So the press is actually the second process after it finishes fermentation. We'll press it off, remove all the skins and seeds, and end up with the wine. So this is still a little cloudy. It's still going to be a little raw tasting.
It's quite vibrant, though. It's got a lot of like red raspberry and almost pomegranate kind of note in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the acidity is going to be insane. So with Sangiovese, one of the things with Sangiovese, the acidity is very high. So it's probably like 3.3 on the pH scale, which is, I don't know, beer-wise what you guys are doing, but this is like white wine style, you know. But what happens with Sangiovese as you let it age, and we'll see a year and 2 years from now, it definitely starts to mellow out, and that acid starts to kind of integrate into the wine to the point where you really don't taste it like you are right now.
I really like this, though. This isn't something that I think people would drink on a regular basis, but this is like a beautiful tart candy in a glass.
It is.
Where it starts out that kind of punch, almost sour tanginess with the raw fruit like you're talking about, Gary, mm-hmm. but then it mellows into a sweetness as it, you know, kind of sits on your palate.
Yeah, and so, it hasn't had any oak or anything. So, I mean, this is, you know, literally it was picked 3 weeks ago.
And the dryness at the end, mm-hmm. is that coming from the grape skins?
The tannins.
That's just from the grape skins themselves.
And the seeds.
Oh, and the seeds.
Yeah, and the seeds. And maybe some stem. You know, there's always a little stem left in there, too, so that definitely helps out.
You had a stowaway during one of your crushes recently.
Yeah, this is, I think, the one you're drinking, right?
Yeah, they had a little lizard that came down from up north in the bins.
He made it all the way through the processing, ended up in the bin, and he was still alive, not even hurt.
Yeah, we rescued him. We put him out in the bushes. I got pictures we'll put up later, but it is a cool process to see the different stages, mm-hmm. and even at this young, you're starting to be able to identify some of the characteristics and the potential of the wine, right?
Sure, yeah. On this one, I definitely get the fruit, and when the acidity starts to mellow out, the fruit's going to get more intense. So what you're going to want to do at that point is how do you counter that? You know, you don't want to have this big Jolly Rancher that you're chewing on. So that's when you start looking at different ways to add oak to it, and also maybe to help age it a little bit to kind of force that acid to kind of marry with everything else that's going on.
Well, I think this is so much fun for me too, in tasting something that I've never tasted before, and I think the dryness really, when I talk about dryness in a beer, where it makes you want to take another drink. That's what's happening here. Mm-hmm. And so this fruit juice with what are we at 11%? Are we at 12% alcohol
Probably 14.5.
So that's a dangerous thing where it tastes like,
and it definitely
it
creates
like
a salivation
juice.
Where you're like, I want to wash that away. I want to get it.
Yeah. That's the acidity for sure. That's one of the great things about wine. One of the reasons it's so stable is because the pH is so low. So low, the acid's so high. Mm-hmm. And the acidity is what winemakers, they're typically call themselves acid heads. They love that acidity that comes out of the vineyard, because it clears everything up, and it kind of just focuses the wine on what's going on. You know, it kind of calls attention to your mouth and says, hey, I'm here, taste me, respect me. Okay, swallow.
When you've mentioned a couple times being able to soften and work through the acidity with oak.
Mm-hmm.
Beer makers use oak for aging. You're not leaving it in the fermentation for aging, though. What style of oak are you using, and how long does it usually sit in the wine?
Well, I'm talking about the oak, the barrel.
Oh, so you're referring to the barrel. Because you use some chips in the beginning, though, right?
We will. So we'll, during fermentation, it's a trick that I learned from a teacher up in UC Davis. He uses what they call raw or seasoned oak. And he likes to use seasoned oak in his fermentation to help, one, solidify the color, and also it helps protect the wine a little bit. And it will add some body to the wine, not a lot, the seasoned oak. The toasted oak is going to do more for it later once it hits barrel. But it's just it's a trick that I've learned to use, and I really like it, and I definitely like it with the Sangiovese. It helps out a lot.
So I apologize, Gary, if we're giving up any secrets.
No, no.
We didn't mean to draw that one.
No. So that cost me $550, that class.
the difference between seasoned oak and regular oak, what makes it seasoned?
So the French are really the master barrel makers. We're making great barrels now here in the U.S., and we've been making for a long time, but really our barrels were primarily focused on the good whiskey down in the Tennessee area is where most of those barrels were going. But what they've learned in over time is they'll actually cut the staves. They'll cut the trees down. They'll make them into what really looks like 2x4s. They'll palletize those guys, tie them down so they don't warp, and they'll set them out to seasons. And they'll stay 3 or 4 years out in the winter, spring, summer, and fall. Mm. And they lose about 80% of their humidity at that point. So you're not worrying about the sap levels. And it actually brings out this great woodiness to the wine. And, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that I'm sure plants into that, spores and everything else that's there. And it just adds a real nice character to the wines, at least. Now, I don't know if that's the same thing they're doing with beer. I really don't know, you know, if they're just kiln drying it or how they're doing it. And they used to only kiln dry everything here because they didn't want to wait 3 years for the product. But so that's what they would call seasoned. And then once the barrel's made, they'll toast it. So depending on the toast levels that you're looking for, from light, medium to dark. And generally, I try to keep it simple and say, hey, light is toffee, medium's caramel, and dark is chocolate or coffee is kind of what's going on. Or vanilla, I guess that you could say for the light toast. And those are typically flavors, seasons flavors that you would get in the wine. And the wine will pick those up depending on how you blend it and what you're working on with that.
And you're using, winemakers are using fresh barrels. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about beer or liquor, they're aging in oftentimes leftover wine barrels, right? You're not going to play with somebody else's barrels. You want the fresh first run of the product.
Sure. For a lot of reasons. When we first started off, we started bringing in a lot of what we called once used barrels. In the wine industry, they might call it one stripe, meaning that it's had one season or one vintage of wine in it. And again, the vintage could be 2 years or 3 years. Sometimes people hold it in barrel for quite some time. But it's typically had what they call one stripe in it. So we brought in a lot of those to kind of build up our inventory because we didn't just want to have all new barrels. And then what we're doing now is we're starting to bring in some new barrels to blend in with some of those once used now and twice used barrels. And once they're kind of through the third vintage, maybe they might be called neutral at that point. And that's where the beer makers are coming to me and saying, hey, as soon as that neutral barrel's ready, can we throw something in there? But really for us, the neutral barrel is a great vessel to hold it. It does allow micro-oxygenation to still happen, but it's really not imparting any flavor, if you will,
and
to the wine.
And it's doing what now?
Micro-oxygenation. So in the beginning, you know, people will say, hey, you don't want oxygen on wine. You don't want oxygen on wine. And no, too much oxygen will definitely cause you problems.
Does it stifle the fermentation?
Actually, for fermentation, you want the oxygen to work in. That's part of the punch down is you are trying to get oxygen back down into it because the CO2 that's coming off is pretty significant. But I'm talking about during the kind of the maturation period, the period where it's just kind of aging.
Okay.
You really don't want a lot of oxygen, but you want enough to help the wine develop. And so what the barrel does is it does allow a little bit of oxygen to pass back and forth through the wood, very small amounts over a long period of time. So I always use the analogy that you're tasting a wine right now, and it's a little rough. There's some edges on it. There's some areas when you're drinking it, you're kind of getting a clink here and a clink there. And if you let this age now, even for a year, you're going to see a big difference on the next round. It's going to be a little softer. So I use the analogy of taking a shard of glass string in the sand dunes, letting the sand dunes kind of grace over that over a year or two. It's going to round it out, and it's going to be a nice, shiny, smooth piece of glass. And so that's what the winemaker is really looking for with the wine barrel.
Excellent. Not to take over your show, but that could be a good break.
Well, Are we ready to do number two here?
We are, if you guys are ready.
I think we just keep going. Go,
you want to truck right through.
I just want to keep going. I just want to get to the next one.
Here, so this is the Sangiovese.
Well, touche.
This is the Sangiovese, and I've got it in a beaker here for you. This is the Sangiovese 1 year in barrel now. So this is 2012 that we've let sit in a barrel for a year. And you can already tell the difference if you look at the first one to the second one. Just look at the color difference on that.
Oh, yeah.
I do like your enthusiasm, Curtis. Not to bring you down a notch, but so we will make
the.
So
it's picking up obviously some of the oak color, you know, from the barrel itself. But also, what's happening too is it's starting to drop some of that acid. The acid's starting to fall out, and as the acid falls out, a good indicator is the color. The brighter the wine looks, the brighter the acid, the more acid you have in it. Kind of the duller it looks. It's starting to lose acidity.
And
so
the vibrancy has definitely changed. You're getting a richer, darker, kind of berry nose, almost like a little bit of a fresh ripe fig kind of tone. So it's not as
here goes Jason. I love this
tangy and sharp as the last batch.
Well, the color alone, the depth of color. And the clarity as well, too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that this is a year old.
That's a year old.
Is quite amazing. I mean, I guess I would have expected in a beer, if it sits for, you know, 3-4 weeks, the difference between a brand new beer and one that's all the sedimentation has dropped out is kind of the same thing. Mm-hmm. How long does it take for the sediment to
once it finishes settle. Fermentation, the first wine you're having, I suspect, is probably still has a little sugar in it. It's probably still going through a tiny bit of fermentation. Mm-hmm. So it's going to look a little bit cloudy for a while. Once the fermentation is done and there's really no more CO2, dissolved CO2 or anything else in, it falls out pretty fast.
The 1 year old is so much fuller than the first one. I mean,
Yeah, that's the oak playing along. That's the microoxygenation that's happening. And it's also clean. You know, the wine has dropped out all of the particulate out of the wine, so you don't have anything in there kind of clouding up the flavors either. And plus, the acidity has started to drop out a little bit.
The sweetness is more pronounced in not a residual sugar kind of way, but definitely there's a more pronounced sweetness. But also, as you're talking through all these other layers, you're starting to get into the more woodsy, vegetal. It's opening up mm-hmm. this diversity in the wine that's really exciting.
But I still get the acidity. You know, it's still there. It's still, especially at the end, and now it's making my mouth water more than it is drying it out. Before it was drying it out. Now my mouth's starting to water. But definitely the acids are starting to drop a little bit, you know, starting to kind of develop within the wine. So that, again, is allowing that sweetness to kind of come out in the wine, too, which is really cool. And I love this Sangiovese. This is a Sangio that we get from Paso Robles.
Are you doing this as a single varietal, or is this for blending?
We will. We'll blend. So the next bottle we'll have is our Super Tuscan, which is called Scoso. And so we blend a little Cab and Merlot into it to make a kind of this... if you want to call it vino noble, they would call it in Italy. But we do have some of the Sangiovese that we bottled last year. Very small amount, one barrel. We call it a one love club. So it's one barrel, 300 bottles that we bottled all by itself. So it was a barrel that we actually went through, tasted them all, picked the one that we wanted, and we barreled that down. And I wish I could open some for you, but that's very limited.
Right?
Yeah. Even for special guests like you, I haven't had it in a long time.
The Sangiovese is the grape, I guess, and the wine that turned me into a wine drinker. I mean, before it was just give or take, whatever. But, you know, when you're in Italy, what are you going to do? And you might as well roll with it. Yeah. And
When in Rome, right?
You know, it doesn't take much more than a bottle of
sure.
it, say,
yeah.
to turn you into a Sangiovese lover, and I just
love.
Are you
going to go from being a hophead to a Sangiohead?
No, not a chance. But when it comes time to pick, that's why I really love just giant, big wines, and it comes from that where it's
kind of the IPA of wine.
Yeah, you know, it's a giant, I don't know, do you call these jam bombs? I don't know, but whatever. Yeah. But I mean, it's, there's just a lot of flavor, and especially when you get, you know, I'm guessing when we get to the two where that the acidity is dropping out even mm-hmm. more, that it's just giant kind of fruit forward sort of
thing.
What's
great about this wine for me, though, this the Sangiovese varietal in this particular glass, is it lends itself to some of those foods that we talk about on a regular basis, some of those heavy savory foods, some of those real kind of acidic, like tomato sauce and focus, but also real minerally mm-hmm. gamey meats. And it pairs really well with that. So I'd have to imagine if you're blending it with some other grapes, it gives you a great palate and a platform to work into. You know, it gives you some diversity across different styles.
Completely. And that's why in Italy they do, Sangiovese itself is the main grape in the Chianti region. So they use, I think, 14 other grapes in that blend. That goes back to like 932 or something. I forgot, it was some cardinal or something put together the formula and said, okay, this is what you will make in this entire region. And they have white wine in there and a bunch of other stuff. But it is the main grape. And so when you're sitting here talking about juicy and big fruit forward and everything else, it's not Italian, you know, because the Italians look at Sangiovese as far as Chianti goes as a very dry kind of food-friendly wine, and it goes very well with that rustic Tuscan food that you're talking about. Almost, very earthy, yeah.
Yeah, almost like a fungus, woodsy focus.
But when you move down into the southern part of the Chianti region, that's where you get into Montalcino and Montepulciano. So in Montepulciano, that's where they have Montalcino is where they have the Brunellos. So that's generally 100% Sangiovese that they've aged for about 5 years before they release it. And they are fruit forward. I mean, when I first had that, I thought, wow, this is like bigger than any Zin I've ever had in California. Just incredibly strong and right in your face kind of wines. Unbelievable. And very, very expensive. And then there's a little town next door. So it's kind of like, you know, Montalcino's like Napa. I'm not dissing Napa and Sonoma, but Sonoma's kind of like Montepulciano. They're a little bit more free with what's going on there. And so they make the wine called Vino Noble, which after I had that, I completely fell in love, because they'll take Sangiovese and blend that with these incredible grapes that their neighbors next door in France have. So you'll see Cab, Merlot, Syrah, all sorts of things mixed in with the Sangiovese. And you're right, Jason. Sangiovese itself, I think, is one of the best wines to blend with, because it offers so much, and you can make a fruit forward, you can make it dry, you can make it so many different styles. And then you take things like Cabernet and Merlot that kind of have the meat and potatoes behind them, and it makes this, I think, an incredible wine.
So what, coming back to my description of it then, so learning how to describe this isn't a jam forward or a big jammy wine, is that?
I would think this one's fruit forward.
Yeah, oh, okay.
I thought
you guys were no. Subtly saying, yeah, okay, and then just let him talk.
No,
and then we'll go into
on.
The
especially
go into
for this
the food,
glass by itself.
But this would be a Brunello, right? So this is 100% Sangiovese.
Okay.
So that is the big fruit. Right. That's the big dude in the Tuscan region. When they blend it with all of the
peanut butter to make a great sandwich. Okay, so you got to get the Cab and the Merlot in to offer a little nuttiness, earthiness.
Well, so my first experience with a Sangiovese was Chianti, mm-hmm. and we did a tour, and we were at the Castello di Verrazzano, mm-hmm. and so we tried their Reservas and everything, and so we brought some of that back. But then the next time we were there, we stayed at in Montalcino, and so we were right in the heart of Brunello, and you know the appellation.
It's small.
It's like this big.
It's around a hill.
Right.
It's around a hill.
It's a roundabout.
Yeah, and that's where if it's a Brunello, it's coming out of this like 10-mile square. Yeah. I mean, really small, and that's one of the things too that I just, those are so big and jammy that's why.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why. I mean, I'm not necessarily a food pair with the wines, but I really like it just to sit in my mouth and just kind of be heavy and full.
Well, in my opinion, if you've had the wines from the Brunello area, you've kind of hit the peak. I don't know. I mean, there's other regions I love. I'm not going to diss the Bordeaux or the Burgundy areas or anything like that. There's fantastic wines. But for my wheelhouse, I'm with you. You give me an incredible Brunello and a big piece of steak, and I'm a happy camper. That's all I need. I don't need anything else. I don't need sides, and I don't need a beer. I'm good to go with just that.
The only thing with that is to finish with a port and a cigar.
Yeah, 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 and you'd sleep happy. So the Brunello region is incredible. I would love to start doing more single varietal and start aging it and see if we could do something like that here. Now, I don't want anybody to get upset and say, oh, you can't do it, you can't do it, you can't do it. And I probably can't, but I can make an effort to do it. We're hoping to get there.
But to move into that realm of thought, as the winemaker, there's a lot of science behind making wine, but there's a hell of a lot of creativity, right? So you're saying, why not make the effort? How much kind of mystic creativity goes into the winemaking that you're doing?
Really, it's just for something like Brunello, it wouldn't be the mystic part of it. It's really a financial. You've got to hold the wine maybe for 3 or 4 years. And so you're not selling it right away. And when you're a little guy like me, you've got to kind of make it and get it out the door.
You want to turn it over.
Yeah, we want to turn it over. So we kind of cheat by doing the Vino Noble because we're able to add Cab and Merlot and kind of move it along a little sooner.
Well, that also requires space too, though, right? If you're going to store for 3 to 4 years, you need the warehouse to put it in.
Exactly. While I love the Vino Nobles, if I was to do it, if I was to do it based on what I really would want to make, it would be 100% Sangiovese. And one of the reasons I'm so adamant about that, and I will somewhere down the road, because I'm learning this fruit, I'm learning this vineyard, I'm working with the farmer every year. Again, we only get once a year to do this. And so we've been working with this farmer since 2008. We had to wait for him to plant for us. So it took 3 years for the plantings to start coming in. We're getting more from him this year. And as we start to build up our inventory on that, then we'll start setting some aside. There's a specific hill portion where I can get some really incredible, I mean, that's what we're drinking right now, but it's some really incredible Sangiovese, very dark, and I'll try to keep that by itself and see if we can make a Brunello, because they've tried here in California several times, and Sangiovese doesn't get the love that some of the other varietals get here in California, but I really think, at least in the West Side Paso area, they can grow it right.
Now, Curtis, we're risking a whole nother show based on the words that are about to come out of my mouth. So I want to be cautious not to delve too deep. But one of the things I want to know is how you're getting access to this fruit. There's so many varietals, so many vineyards, and a lot of farmers out there nowadays that are growing fruit. How do you discern where you want to target, how you get access to the fruit, and even to the point of how do you get permission?
That was the hardest thing that we had to go through. When we decided that we were going to start making wine professionally, if you will, in 2008, it took us a year and a half before harvest of 2008 to find all the fruit that we wanted. Now, we were doing home winemaking. We had some decent contacts through some classes I took at UC Davis and a few people that I met through UC Davis. I was able to find farmers. But it truly is, especially if you're in Ventura and you're not in Paso, you're not in Napa, it's not easy. You don't just open up Craigslist and say, okay, well, I'm going to, under grapes, Sangiovese, Paso Robles. Oh, there we go. We got a whole list of people. They really don't have anything out there like that.
Are you knocking on a lot of doors and using the buzzer gate?
Exactly. Yeah. Typically what you're doing, though, honestly, is you're tasting somebody else's wine and you're saying, oh my God, this stuff is incredible. And then you start trying to figure out where did you get it from. So honestly, you are kind of stealing from your neighbor a little bit, or borrowing from your neighbor.
Do they hold that close to themselves?
Some winemakers will not let you know. They won't divulge anything because they're trying to protect their stash with the farmer. And of course, the farmers are savvy. They don't really want to be not known, because if somebody else comes up and asks for more money, it's kind of like, the NBA center, right?
Definitely.
I mean, if we come through and I score a 95 points out of this in Wine Spectator and become Wine of the Year, you bet your bottom dollar he's going to ask me for more money the next year. Mm-hmm. And I might get booted out by somebody even bigger. You just don't know.
Overspend.
Yeah, so it definitely can happen in the wine industry. We're very tight with our farmers, and you know we're good to them. They're good to us, but and we haven't been booted out yet. And I've got a couple good ones, and I think this Sangiovese. Mm-hmm. I mean, this Sangiovese that we're about to drink, the 2010, scored 89. It's the highest rating from Wine Spectator in quite some time for Sangiovese in California. It just doesn't get the love that Cab and Pinot get, and 89 is pretty respectful.
So that's a nod to the fruit and the farmer then.
It is. It 100%. And I always say that, you know, a winemaker, we get to add little nuances. We get to take care of a few little things, but essentially I just look at myself as a custodian. I mean, you've been here, Jason, there's more cleaning that goes on than there is winemaking.
The sanitation process is lengthy.
It just takes forever. And it's all about getting great fruit and keeping it clean all the way through to bottle. And if you've done your job, then you've done a great job as a winemaker. And then any accolades that come from that bottle of wine, it truly goes back to the farmer. He's the guy that did it, you know, or lady.
That's an interesting perspective too. And I've been hearing it more and more lately. You know, we have our friends at Beacon Coffee, and they go do these origin trips down to the farmers in South America where they're sourcing beans from. They're meeting the guys, shaking their hands, seeing the product. Same thing with a lot of brewers that we know. When it comes to cooking, the chefs are going to say the same thing. If you start with a great ingredient and a great base, as Gary, you mentioned a minute ago, you can tweak it a little bit, you can add your own personal touch and characteristic, but it takes the origin of the great ingredient to set the foundation, right?
It really does. And if there's probably three winemakers that are making wine with this grape right now in California, I venture to say if I tasted any of their bottles, the DNA would show through. You'd really see that it's there, you know, it's that grape that's going on. Now, they might have used some funky oak or something that maybe added their own little characteristic to it, but you're going to see the DNA shine through.
I think that's a great statement, just because coming from a brewery background where I've finally gotten to a point where I can taste certain malts, I can taste certain hops, and I can taste some of these different sorts of aspects, and it just comes from immersion in it and tasting.
Exactly.
And for you to say that about wine, I go, wow, could you really do it? And then I think, well, wait, I've been able to do it with these ingredients. So sure, this is a grape that you're intimate with, that it's your baby when it's here. And so
sure,
of course you could go to these other three and
yeah, I've been tasting it at this stage that we just had for you know, since 2008. So I know what it tastes like after a year. I know what it tastes like after 6 months. I know what it tastes like after 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I know what it tastes like when it's been in bottle for 4 years. So, yeah, I'm very, very intimate with it. And I would look at it as the same thing. I mean, I know hops are a big deal with brewers. And there's probably certain hops out there, and I don't know, but I'm sure there's certain hops where everybody's clamoring to get those hops because they just have you know, a certain richness to it or spice that maybe some of the other hops don't. Mm-hmm. And you can tell when so-and-so is using that hop, it's going to show, that DNA is going to shine through. I don't care if it's a triple IPA or a quadruple IPA. It's still going to shine through.
I think he's onto something. A quadruple IPA. And that's something I can get behind.
Would we ever entertain, okay, Gary, close your ears, earmuffs. Would we ever entertain dry hopping a wine?
I don't know. I think there could be.
Doesn't your dog do that when you greet her?
I think you know, looking at some noble hops, something that's a little spicier. There's some that certainly have an earthy, peppery note to it. I think there's a possibility.
Now, what do you mean dry hop?
Well, he's just talking about adding hops. So you've got this fermented wine already. And then
in a wine itself, and then
throwing it into the barrel. Now, there's hop extracts and other things so that you could work on a glass by glass, you know, a drop here, you know, especially in your nice little Erlenmeyer flask there. And then you just a little drop in there and you taste it and you go, oh, well, maybe.
Well, especially with this really young Sangio that we just tasted, it's, again, that vibrant, bright, almost tart kind of fruit. I was thinking to myself, there's a lot of citrus kind of focused hops. There's some piney, resiny kind of hops. Mm. I wonder if anything would pair well. I mean, it's an avenue that no one has ever driven down.
Not that I know.
an idea has just been hatched, and I'm pointing at all three of us like, hey, this is.
So for everyone listening, we're going to send you an
NDA. Hophead wine.
Yeah, we'll send you a non-disclosure. Be sure to throw it out.
You do not get to share this. We won't talk about it anymore.
Cut the tape.
We won't talk. We won't talk about it anymore. I'm really excited to taste the 2-year-old. And I think as Gary's pouring it here, I'll pass this over your way. I want to point out behind us on the webcams, you can see the barrel room, the cellar, I suppose.
Yep, I'm going to step out of the camera shot for a second, share my glass with my wife who showed up, and let you get a better view of the cellar room.
So we've got, Gary, tell us how many barrels do you have hiding back there?
Right now we have right around 100 back there. So that what's back there right now, for the most part, is our 2012 harvest. So this is where I just pulled, actually the second wine that we tried came out of one of the barrels back there. All the stuff that's getting ready to be filled up in 2013 is across the way from us. And as we're filling up and running out of floor space here, we'll keep pushing stuff over there. And then when we're done with harvest, it all comes back over into the barrel room. So it's about 100, and you get about 300 bottles per barrel.
Oh.
Everything except for these two guys right here that are probably the closest right on the ground, those are actually barrel fermenting Viognier, something we're trying a little different this year. So we took a little Viognier and put it into some good old American oak, and we're going to let it go through fermentation in the barrel.
So are the air stoppers on the top here where they'll vent by themselves? Or are you?
Yeah, so it's got a little burpee up there. You know, if there's too much too much CO2 coming through, it'll kind of just, you know, move to the side, kind of like we do when we're comfortable.
Sure. Sure. Well, one of the things that we didn't talk about when we came in, when we started too, was just the aroma that's here. I mean, you've got did I see 8 bins back there? And those are 2 tons apiece?
No, each bin's holding about a half a ton.
A half a ton, okay.
So there's about 4 tons. It's actually about 4.5 tons of Tempranillo on the floor right now.
And the aroma coming out of those, they're open. Now they're covered just to make sure nothing's, you know, when you're driving your forklift, whatever. But it still has permeated the air. One of the things that, my sense is, my sense of smell has been kind of fatigued a little bit, so I don't smell it. And especially now that I've got these big ones here too, it's kind of faded away into the background. Yeah. But there was such a wonderful wine smell when we walked in here.
Mine's fatigued to the point where I don't smell it anymore, which is sad. But I know what you're smelling. To me, it smells like cherry bread. Yeast rising, this kind of just incredible flavor and smell. And all of my neighbors, when I drive up, I mean, 3 doors down, they'll say, "Oh my God, it smells so wonderful here in the morning. We can't wait to show up and see what the next smell is." And it's an incredible aroma coming out of it.
Yeah, and I think maybe on the brewery side, unless, of course, they're just constantly going, which some breweries are that big and still doing that. Can you get by? It spikes, and so you get this really giant hop aroma that's filling, and then it's gone. You know,
and I love that smell.
So every time I'm fermenting, anyway, I can always smell that. And you walk into breweries, and so I'm wondering. I mean, unless they're going 24 hours a day, and they've but then that's a giant macro brewery, and they're not using hops anyway. So, but that's beside the point. But that's one of the things. I'm kind of sad for you that you're
over time it's happened to me. So I'll walk in, and it's funny because every once in a while, like, somebody will come in like you guys and say, "Oh my gosh, the smell is incredible." So in my mind, I know what it is. I'm not smelling it. I don't know why. I think it's just something happens with us.
I think it opens a conversation though. You'd mentioned earlier the crush crew going through the blending process, bringing in other people's perspective. I know I talked with Janice over Plan B a while back, and they were talking about having the house stock of wine. Because I asked them, how many bottles of your wine do you have in your household or your cupboards? And they said, not hardly any, because they taste it so frequently that they start, getting numb and dull to it. Is that why you enlist some other, friends and individuals to help you with that process? Or
definitely, and I definitely don't drink a lot of my wine. I'll be the first one to tell you that. I had a very good friend of mine, Rick Quinn, who owns Opolo Vineyards, he told me a long time ago, he said, "Hey, don't drink all of your wine all the time, because you're going to develop a point where your wine is the only wine that tastes good and everybody else's wine is bad." And he said, that's not true. So he said, you've got to keep creating. You've got to keep looking out there. So I constantly am looking for other wines, other things that I want to get involved with. If if Grenache is my focus right now and I really just want to make this incredible Grenache, I'll go out and seek every great Grenache I can understand and look at and really try to take it apart and figure out what they're doing and how these masters have crafted this stuff.
Well, it seems similar to other industries too, where especially in the craft part of it, so in the smaller segments of whether it's spirits or it's beer or it's wine, that we love to taste everyone else's too. Mm-hmm. And we're happy when we taste something brand new, you know, and we will congratulate people when they have something that tastes wonderful. And there's a certain amount of maybe competition in that we're all raising ourselves up, but still we understand the importance of tasting other things so we don't go stale.
I think that's always the hope, and the people that don't follow or fall into that will definitely phase themselves out. You mm-hmm. know? And I think you can probably attest, Gary, there are a lot of wineries that are building up right here near your winery, but in Ventura County alone, once one winery is successful and wins, everybody is successful and wins.
Oh, there's no doubt. I do everything I can. You mentioned Marlo and Janice over at Plan B. They're very good friends of ours. We did everything we can to help them get into this neighborhood. We're super excited to have them here. And I'll call up Marlo when I'm heading. I'll call up all my friends. I consider them all my friends here in the wine trail. When I'm heading up to Paso or San Ynez, I'll say, hey, I'm up there. Do you guys need anything? I'll pick it up. Do you need fruit? What's going on? You know, I mean, because we're all bogged down. It's a lot of work this time of the year. And they are. I'm hoping to God that one of them scores a 99 and gets wine of the year, because people will show up here in Ventura.
If you build it, they will come.
Yeah, exactly. So
the market that grows up around one success just pulls everything in.
Yeah. Stone IPA, right? Or Stone. I mean, you go down mm-hmm. to Stone now, and how many breweries are around Stone?
Yeah, San Diego is a crazy place.
Yeah.
So we're drinking the 2-year-old, and this is SCOSO, is that right?
Yeah, so this is 2010 SCOSO. Now it's 64% Sangiovese, and we've added on this one about 26% Cab and 10% Merlot, all from vineyards that we still purchase from in Paso Robles. So this would be the Vino Noble.
Well, I've going from every one of these, especially the V&A earlier, and then these steps all the way through. You know, it's been three different wines, and I've appreciated each one for what they are. This one is just, it's fantastic. The edges are
rounded,
gone, and it's just
the oak's kind of taken it down. Right. The acid's dropped a little bit, it's just what happens over a 2-year period. It's pretty magical.
And we're drinking the 2010 right now. I think you'd be surprised to know, though, Curtis, that the recipe is not the same year after year, even though the nameplate may remain. So, Gary, this 2010 SCOSO is not going to necessarily be the same percentage breakdown as your 11, right? And can you explain why?
It really has to do with tasting. So at that point, we'll sit down, and this is where we're going to bring the Crush crew in. One more thing we're going to do with you guys this year. We're going to sit down, and you guys are going to go through the tastings. And so what we do is we literally will sit down with the three components, Sangiovese, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Merlot by itself. We'll taste each of those by themselves. And this is the way I was taught to do it. So not every winery does it this way. There are some that just say, hey, every man in the boat, and I don't care what it tastes like, and they'll ship it off. You know, and that would be the guys that you were referring to earlier that have the big pipelines that go to the hotels, right? So that'd be those guys. But the craft guys, the guys that are really serious about this stuff, they'll sit down and they'll taste the three components, and they'll work on a blend that makes sense. And so what they'll do is, you know, on those three components, they'll write down their notes. And then we'll blend it all together. We'll say, okay, here we go. It's all in.
Different increments, right? You're not just dumping it into a bucket.
Yeah, so we'll do, you know, 70, 30, 10 or something, whatever it is. 70, 30, 10. Yeah, that's 100, right? we'll do that. You know, if that's what we have in barrel, we'll do that. And we'll say, okay, cross your fingers. I hope that works. And it never does. That'll kind of give us our starting point. And based on our notes, we'll be able to say, hey, you know, that cherry flavor that we were getting with the Sangiovese is kind of gone. So maybe we need to back down the other two, you know, kind of pull the level from, you know, 5 to 4 and raise the Sangiovese up again so we can get that cherry that we were looking for. Or the finish has really gotten dry. The Merlot had this luscious finish. So maybe we need to pick the Merlot up a little bit to help with the finish.
Is that how you end up with a really obscure numbers, though. I mean, 64% Sangio is an odd number. So if you're working on a like a 1 to 10 scale, so we want three parts of this, four parts of that, three parts of the other, how do you get into the...
It's amazing, and I guarantee you when we were going through this, I can almost guarantee you we tried 63% and we tried 65%. And 64 worked. It's really weird. I mean, you're filling up a graduated cylinder with 100 mils of wine, and you're putting in 64 mils of Sangiovese and 26 mils of Cab and 10 of Merlot, and you pour it out, and it's like, okay, this is great. You change anything by a percent here or there, it's totally different. It really is a little bit like trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sometimes it's frustrating.
Would you be able to do that, Curtis? Could you drink through that many glasses?
Yes.
Let me be
definitive on that. Yes, I could.
You get about six cracks at it, though, before your mouth says, I'm done.
Right. So, working at with milliliters, because you're talking about 100 milliliters right there. So you can see how small of amount you're using between, between three, four different people. So.
Well, we'll use more than that. But I mean essentially, sure. So we might use, a liter, so 1,000 mils and break it down, especially if we had the crush crew and there's eight people there, we're going to have to get enough to go around. Right. But yeah, I mean, it's just when you look at this and you say, okay, that's 100 and, 64%, it's literally, that's the way you do it. I mean, it's simple math.
To delve into the financials a little bit, though, with all this tasting and blending that takes place, and you just mentioned you may use a whole liter of, one particular varietal, that yield is all factored in, right? So when we're talking about a $35 bottle of wine, all that waste of preparation, and waste is a harsh term, but all the wine that's been wasted in preparing that bottle is accounted for. I mean, you're not just giving away wine hoping that you're going to get the perfect bottle. It has to be figured out somewhere.
And that's not even the biggest loss. The biggest loss is actually out of what we were talking about earlier, the barrel itself. So in two years, you lose a lot of wine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing how much actually evaporates out. But what happens is it becomes richer. So you're losing kind of the lean part of the wine, and it's building a richer wine. So that's why the 5-year-old aged Brunellos are so big and so beautiful, because they've just thickened up and kind of got some broad shoulders on them.
I'm kind of at a loss right now.
I'm in a really happy. At home, folks can't see it if they're just listening, but you just swirling.
I'm in a really happy wine space right now. And
We've got some cheese here later.
Listening to the conversations have been really great, and just enjoying just a fantastic wine right here. And I've had this a couple times, and I had maybe a year ago. Would it have been this bottle, possibly?
Yeah, sure.
And it seemed like there were some sharper edges on it. And this one is, a year of aging in the bottle has come to...
Yeah, and unfortunately, it is just now coming into its own. I think, and we will hold some back,
So unfortunately, because...
It's almost gone. Ah. Yeah, it'll be gone. In fact, today we found out it might be gone.
Okay. Well, aging is something that is kind of an arbitrary focus, right? I mean, we've seen news reports of champagnes and wines have been brought up from the bottom of the ocean from shipwrecks, and they're still drinkable 100 years later. But there is a threshold for every wine. What do you estimate the Sangio or the Scosso to kind of tap out at?
A lot of it, I feel, and different winemakers have different perspectives on this. They'll say it's the acid, it's the way the wine's made. I really think it's the pedigree of the wine. Again, it's back to the DNA of the actual varietal itself. And Sangiovese is one that can hang. There's no doubt that Cabernet, Sangiovese, Merlot, I don't care what part of the world you're buying it from, if it's made right and grown right, those wines can last a long, long time. Where something like Zinfandel, I don't care how well you make Zinfandel, the DNA isn't there to hold on to it forever. It will flatten out, and it'll just kind of become blah after time.
So with that said, Curtis, before we get into last call shortly, do you want to run through? And I mean, Gary's got a lot of bottles up on his shelf. He's got a pretty significant resume for Four Bricks. Should we talk about any other options that he
has? Well, the other one that's one of my favorites is the Bobbles, and that'll be in.
You got to have it last year on your show. We popped it.
It was one of the last bottles that you had going through. It was already sold out by that point.
Yeah, and so that's a champagne that we make. We actually make it up in Sonoma County because I don't have all the process here to go through. And we talked about it on the second show, the disgorging and all the stuff that actually happens to make a Champenoise method champagne. And it's a Blanc de Noir, so it's done with Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Incredibly good wine, and we should have some here that pretty shortly.
It blew us away.
Yeah,
and we had Bree and I think went through two or three bottles. We tried to secure as much as we could. It was delicious. It was fruity. It was, you know, a lot of stone fruit and some effervescence. It's a great. For the first run, you have to give a little pat on the shoulder.
Well, yeah, no. And I give a lot of that to the lady who's the winemaker up there, too. Trust me. I mean, she helped me with procuring the fruit. She really sat down with us and told us, you know, this is champagne. And believe me, I've never made it before. So I was eyes wide open going into this and listened to everything she said. And thank God she did a great job.
Well, I am I'm a member, so Jason is on the Crush crew. I'm a member, and so I'll be watching very closely for when it's announced that it's here, because I want a few bottles myself too, but I just want everyone to know that this is it, you know, the talk from last year and how fast it sold out. I can only imagine that it's going to do the same. Are you increasing production this year at all?
We did. You know, we had made more last year, but it's a non-vintage. So we're using two different vintages to make the wine each year. And we thought, oh, man, we sold out so quick. Let's just bring in the next. And it wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. So we tasted it and we said, no, you're right. You know, she warned us. And so we did wait. And I think we're going to be happy for it. We just had the first bottle come down a few weeks ago. They're getting ready to disgorge, and they wanted to find out, do you think it's ready? They sent one down with all the junk in it still and everything, and we were excited.
Look at that smile.
that's all you need to know. Back. He was trying to be humble, but you could see it shining through.
No, we were excited.
Yeah, this is a damn good one.
You have a lot of excitement around a couple other ones, too. You've got a Petite Syrah, mm-hmm. that's kind of a reserve for you that comes out only every couple of years.
Yeah, it was a mistake. The Petite Syrah, we blend that. We make, you know, so Four Bricks, and I think everybody kind of, well, you've got a bigger audience now, so I shouldn't assume that. Four Bricks, Bricks the measurement of sugar, and it's kind of the four regions that the couples traveled to and kind of fell in love with certain wines, as mm-hmm. as you did with the Brunello, and so did we. But we also make, it's our four sweet spots. So we also make a tribute to not only Italy, we do one for France, Spain, and then, of course, California. And the Petite Syrah came about in our California wine, which is a Zinfandel, another very popular wine. It's a Zinfandel Petite Syrah blend. And 2008 and 2009, we ordered fruit thinking this would be about the right amount, and we were way wrong. We had leftover Petite Syrah to the point of a barrel of it. I mean, which isn't a lot, but for a little guy that's just starting off, it was a lot.
That's a good solid 60 gallons, right?
Yeah, 60 gallons, about 300 bottles. And so we didn't know what to do with it. And when we moved down to Ventura and opened up shop, we kind of started it as just kind of a club member only thing, thinking, okay, this might catch on. And it was super popular. And we made it again in 2000. Well, that was 2009. The 2008 we'd already gotten rid of. We lost the fruit in 2010. The farmer did not take any fruit out of the vineyard at all. So we bought double the amount in 2011. So this year it won't be just club member only. We'll be able to release that to the public, and we're pretty excited about it. It's a real nice Petite Syrah from a cool climate area. So typically we're having Petite Syrah here from Paso Robles. It's very brawny, big wine. This one's much more elegant, I think, and a little softer edge. And it'll be good. We're excited to release that, and that'll be here next month.
And another one, if I could pop my collar on, because I've had a couple of bottles, that people clamor for is your Porto.
Yes, yeah, the Porto is so one of the things that we try to do here, because, you know, this is a fledgling wine area, you know, right now we're trying to start up, we're trying to get things going. So one of the things that we try to do here at Four Bricks is kind of do these things where you can kind of come in and try some different stuff. Plus, it allows me to have fun too back there. So we do the champagne, and we also do a port. which is a Bagnuol style port. It's a really cool port. It's made 100% Grenache, just like the Bagnuol area of France, much less sugar and lower alcohol. So it's, to me, much more of a food-friendly wine. It'll go, to me, it goes better with desserts, but you can also use it with, you know, it also does great with cheeses for a dessert. I really like it. And the first year we did it, that was another one. It was a big argument with the owners of the company, you know, the partners. I wanted to do port. They thought I was nuts. So we ended up making 30 gallons, and that was another one where it was a mistake because it was all gone in a flash of a hat. So the second year they allowed me to make more, I got to make a whole barrel of it. So we actually ended up with 600 bottles, or, you know, they're half bottles. So 600 bottles, just shy of 600 bottles. And this year they allowed me to make 3 barrels. So we'll have enough Porto for everybody now.
That's interesting that he says they allowed him to do that because he's the winemaker. He's kind of the heart of what ends up in the bottle. But at the same time, like an artist, he has to work on what's being commissioned. What are the people asking for?
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll see this in distilleries. You'll see on the spirit side. You'll certainly see it in the beer side where the brewers want to do something, but they've got their flagship beer that they've got to brew 4 times a week in order to pay the bills so that you can make a port. And I totally understand it. I was in last fall. Well, wait, no. That would have been spring, I guess. Yeah, and we got a tasting right out of the barrel. Oh, that was so fabulous.
Yeah,
and that's what you're talking about.
That's in bottle now. It's sitting over in the warehouse right now, and we'll be releasing that in the fall. Also,
as a member, you might have access, Curtis.
Yeah. We'll definitely gobble them up. And it goes really well, by the way. We were pouring the Bobaltinis, remember?
Yeah.
They were actually adding a little port to the champagne. Kind of like a Kirsch Royale champagne thing. Oh my God, it was really good.
And again, that gives, you know, being the winemaker and having the cellar room here, you can kind of play around.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have your core wines. You've got the Petite Sirah, like you talked about. Mm-hmm. You've got Bobbles, which is kind of a newer addition to the lineup, and the Porto. But you've got two whites. You just released a new white recently.
Yeah, so Desirous is the newest white. It's a Grenache Blanc that we make from, which is almost all half-oaked Grenache Blanc that we pull out of Camp Four Vineyards in Santa Ynez, where we're doing more fruit from this year. The Viognier that you had earlier was also from Camp Four. So those are the two whites that we currently make.
And we move into a Roséo.
And then we have a Rosé, which with the Grenache, we do three things with Grenache. We make Rendezvous, which is one of our flagship wines. That's our Chateauneuf de Pape style. So Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, and Cunoise.
That's just
like to say Chateauneuf de Pape.
That wine, yeah, I do. That wine is just now coming into its own. That wine takes longer than any of the others to come into its own. But as soon as it comes into its own, it's too late. And that's where it's at right now. And that wine, for me, I'm with you, Curtis. It's one of those wines that I love it. And then we also, with the Grenache, we also make a rosé. So we make the port, and then we also make a rosé with that. And that's where we get a little earlier. We press it off. We leave it on the skins for 2 or 3 days, and then we pull that off and barrel age that for a short time.
That's another great rosé, because for me, it's not super, how do I even describe it? You know, a lot of rosés are very pink. They're very cherry or raspberry focused. This, for me, has a little more melon. It's a little softer, some stone fruit, and it's not as sugary. A lot of rosés can be very residual sugar.
Yeah,
focused.
This is definitely Provence style.
Zinfandel, is that what you're saying?
No, sir.
Yeah, it's, hey, Sutterholm has a lot of money. They made a lot of money off of White Zinfandel. And that was a mistake, by the way. You know that, right? The wine got stuck, and he had an issue, and it's a great story on there. But
that they capitalized on.
Oh, huge! Yeah, huge. And you know that winemakers do that all the time. Trust me. Late harvest isn't always late harvest. Late harvest could mean the wine stuck, and we got to do something with this. You know, it's got sugar in it. How we do this? So they put a slap a label on it, say late harvest, and they charge extra for a screw up. So trust me, it happens.
Well, let's take a break. We've been going at it.
We're rocking it.
We've been going for about 1.10 hours now on this segment.
I think it's great content. It shows to a little accolade to the winemaker about the knowledge and information being conveyed. But every show I do with you, no matter the label on the show, seems to go a little longer each time.
sometimes when I don't have constraints around me, like a really, you know, people walking in and out or whatever it is, then I could just sit here for an hour. And
I love it. I hope one day we're on in the mornings for like 6 hours drinking for 6 hours.
That may happen. So let's go to a break. We'll come back in just a few minutes, get up, stretch a little bit. I've got a beer to kind of finish off on last
wash
fall.
Our palates with.
Right. And clean it out. It was the most wine-like beer I had in my freezer or in my freezer. Yeah, because I freeze my beer.
Looks like champagne.
It is. It's in a Cajun cork bottle. So from Lost Abbey. So we'll have some good beer when you come back.
So you're listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis.
And Jason, of course. There he is. All right, we'll catch you in a bit.
And now, back to the show.
Hi, Jason.
Hey, welcome back.
Hey, alcohol, my party time necessity, as the Bare Naked Ladies like to say. You might see behind us.
We got some action going
on. Yeah, Gary's back there. He's mixing up some stuff. Bree's trying to sneak by, but ha, we caught her.
She's on camera. Yeah, and we're closing out Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis with some footage, some action shots.
Right, so Gary's mixing up some Viognier that's in the cask, barrels, I guess they call them here, and mixing it up.
In these parts, they call them barrels.
I guess in these parts, they're barrels. But anyway, so he's mixing it up just to get the lees up and off the bottom, and then to introduce a little more oxygen in there for some fermentation to take care of.
And in all seriousness, we talked earlier about the amount of sanitation that goes into winemaking. We hear the spritzing going on. Gary, just put the bungs back in the barrels. And
this is what we use to clean the barrel.
A little vodka. But I mean, sanitation is the key. So
it's a great shot.
Just like we don't want to impart any funkiness and bacteria to most beers, unless you're searching for a sour or a specific bacteria. Gary doesn't want any of that stuff in his wine either.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, so we'll use vodka to break down the sugary wine on the outside.
We're gonna mic you back up, Gary.
Well, there we go. We'll get you a mic. So before we get going, though, I want to make sure that I give a shout out to my driving service. We're driving, and they'll be coming here. What's so great about it is I set it up tonight because we were off location, and I figured I wasn't going to be hanging out and doing everything. But we went long because it's just, you're such a gracious host, and just seriously, I mean, and having us here and then letting us
a lot of great info coming out,
right?
Too.
And just letting us talk and talk and talk all the way through it. So I quick sent him a text and I said, "Hey, I'm running late. Can we push it back to my regular time? Get a text back." Yes, you can. So I know that after I've had 3 half glasses of wine, we're going to have some beer here, that I'm in good shape to go home. You've got your DD right there, it looks like.
She's been learning a little bit about wine, but she's not drinking. So I've got my DD lined up, and we will call that Bree's Taxi Service. But your service is We're Driving.
We're Driving. So go to weredriving.com. It's a great service. You can set it up or give them a call in about a half hour or an hour. They'll come pick you up and your car, get you home with your car so that you don't have to go searching for it in the morning. It's a beautiful
car. We use it here at the winery all the time.
Oh, fabulous.
I was on your show last year, and we found out about those guys, and we have their number in here. So when people are here, we'll say, hey, don't worry, enjoy. We're driving. We'll get you guys home.
And as we mentioned in the past, a lot of anxiety usually comes in with getting your car and your property home. And with We're Driving, they take care of that. There's ease and there's comfort in getting your property and yourself home safely, and everyone else around you is home safely. And from what I understand, Curtis, the bonus perk is some great conversations.
Great conversation on the way home, because I'm always chatty. So the guys, whoever is driving me, they do a really good job of just letting me be chatty and chat along with me on the way home. But so go to weredriving.com. That's weredriving.com. And I got to imagine that people come in for tastings. And you know, between my wife and I, whenever we come in, so if we're out together and it's a brewery tour, she's driving. If we go wine tasting, I'm driving, I guess. But some relationships aren't necessarily so diverse, and they both want their wine. And yeah. So I can imagine that from time to time you get people here who enjoy their samples just maybe a little bit too much.
And we'll have parties here too. So during the holidays, we'll have some pretty good company parties here. And People will get a little carried away having fun. You know, they're blown off steam. They've been working all year. It's time to celebrate. Sure. I love the holidays. And they'll get worried about it. You can see, like you were talking about, they're very worried about getting a taxi and then having to get back here in the morning. And we're driving. They're just great.
Well, and looping back to one of our conversations earlier in the show, you were mentioning kind of the whole process of guests and what it takes to bring in all these different wineries, and you know how they'll flock to an area that has great winery and maybe some other wineries around them, or just a good handful of quality wineries in general. You've been getting some good parties that show up actually in a limo and they just bounce around from location to location.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a full wine scene here now. It's pretty cool. And beer scene. The whole spirit scene here is actually going off. We have, you know, right down the street from us, Ventura Limoncello, some incredible limoncello. We have a few guys now that are starting to do some craft distilling in the area. So the off-market area of Ventura is really starting to be known for more than just wine.
So that's our tourism plug for the night. Visit Ventura. You've got great wineries here in off-market. You've got breweries with Surf Brewery just down the way. We've got Institution Ales just down the freeway. We got Anacap. You name it.
World-class restaurants and fantastic hotels right on the beach.
We're starting to come into our own.
Absolutely. Should we drink some beer?
Let's toast to that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I've got Lost Abbey, the Ten Commandments right here. And
those are broken tonight.
Let's not break any of them. How's that sound? It's just being a good person. You know, let's not do any of these to each other. How's that sound? So brewed with honey, raisins, and rosemary. So as I was looking through my beer cave at home, my personal beer cave, and as I was looking for, I had a couple pulled out, and I thought, oh, these would be, you know, at least... I after drinking a whole bunch of wine, I didn't want to throw an IPA at us. You know, no, that's just way too on the spectrum. Let's see what I have closest maybe to a wine sort of spectrum. And this one came out. And what's really nice about this bottle is after Hophead Said's third anniversary, I came home to a gift bag that was on the... So we had happy hour that night. I got home, there was a gift bag on it, and this was in it. So my family, right, my support group, my wife and my kids were thinking of me. So I've got one of the great things about these two is that they're Cajun cork, bottle conditioned. So, you know, just really great, creamy, itty bitty, teeny tiny bubble carbonations, great mouthfeel. So as I do this, we'll end up, get this to pop out.
There's the sound.
There it is. And... smells like a good beer. So we'll pour this out and pass it down.
So it has dry. It does have dry grape in it. Raisin.
There you go. Yes, it does. And then the wine trail. We hit that just a little bit.
Yeah.
And so there's an. Are you the head of the Ventura?
No.
County Wine Trail?
No, thank goodness, no. Actually, the Ventura County Wine Trail is a group of us that kind of work together, but it's really ran by a kind of a side business for Herzog Winery. And Herzog Winery in Oxnard is really the big guy in the area. So Joseph Herzog and his family kind of feel... you know, a custodialship, I guess, that, you know, they should have taken this on, and they did. And so we work with them on putting the wine trail together. And the idea behind it is to have a map and kind of identity of what's going on. So when people do come and stay in the western side of Ventura County, they have something more to do than just go surf and islands and all of the other stuff that Ventura has always had to offer. Now there's actually a thriving wine trail. I think there's 21 wineries on the wine trail from Ojai to Thousand Oaks. And the heart of them are here, though, on Oxnard Plain.
Well, it's the... When we first moved here, let me start back just even a little further. It was 4 years ago when we first moved here. There was... We got the Ventura County Wine Trail map, and there were three or four people on it. That's all. And now, you know, what you're saying, there's 21 wineries now.
And how many breweries have popped up?
Well, yeah, and along the whole coast. I mean, starting in West... well, let's go to Calabasas, you know, starting Calabasas
Lady
all the way
face.
To Buellton and Paso Robles. I mean, there's... You can't go 20 minutes for a brewery 40 minutes on the long side from here to, or from Santa Barbara to Buellton, but otherwise it's the same for wineries around here.
Well, and to the credit of, again, that culture, you know, helping each other out, you've got a couple wineries within a few blocks of you.
Oh yeah.
And it's,
yeah,
a stone's throw. We don't want to lose sight, though. I mean, we're getting ready to enjoy this really lovely beer, and we've been talking all about the cool process of how you're making wine here at Four Bricks. We want to talk about how people can get a hold of your wine, though. Where can, if they're listening three states away and they're not a member, they can't come in from a pickup party, how do they get a bottle of your wine?
Well, a lot of that depends on the state, because we all know that every state has its own alcohol laws. But for most of the states, we have license, so we can ship to them. If they want to get a hold of us, they can go online to fourbrickswine.com, FourBrixWine.com, or they can always give us a call, 805-256-6006, and my beautiful wife, Karen, will answer the phone and definitely take care of you.
And all the wines that are on fourbrickswine.com have the description, they've got a bottle, the label, the artwork. You're doing it, your artwork in-house. You kind of have a creative vision on that side, too. So you want to divulge any of your secrets?
Yeah, we work together on that. And we, you know, when we first came out with our labels, people kind of scoffed at them. Honestly, they did, because it's not conventional. The name of our wine, the name of actually the wine itself, for example, Scoso. You can't see this maybe out there in TV land, but Scoso itself is the predominant label. It's the predominant part of the label. Four Bricks is kind of a secondary, and the idea behind that is because we make blends, and blends are not something that's typically common in California. And so rather than saying, hey, that's the Four Bricks blend of Sangiovese, Cabernet, Sauvignon, and Merlot, we decided that we wanted to market it as Scoso.
And that nameplate will stay consistent regardless of the percentage changes each year. Or
exactly.
Each vintage, right?
Exactly. So when they come in, they know they want a Super Tuscan, they're going to ask for Scoso. And it's worked. It really has. And so I haven't gone back to the people yet that have scoffed me because they're still not buying my wine, but somewhere down the road.
Just send them a bottle for the holidays.
Exactly. Exactly. So
sign it anonymous.
Yeah, yeah, it's just our way of doing it because, you know, hey, at the end of the day, I still belong to wine clubs. I still, you know, drink other wine like I talked about. And I get confused sometimes on, you know, is that the, you know, they might have a name on there, but it's like, you know, Vulture's Crest. And it's so small that you don't know, you know, what it is and what it really stands for. So we tried to keep it real clean and plain and simple. And then a lot of the times we'll play with on the characters of what's going on.
You have a lot of great events in that you're putting on the cellar and the Bricks House as well, though. All that stuff's on the website. So if you're in Ventura County, you're making a trip through Ventura and you want to stop in here, you're doing Foodie Fridays.
Yeah, and First Fridays now, too. So this First Friday is coming up this week. We First Friday's home for Scratch Food Truck.
Scratch.
So Tim Kilcoyne, who, for those of you that never got to go to his restaurant, he's now has his food truck, and the guy is just off the chart great. Tim is, first of all, he's just a great guy, and secondly, he's a mad scientist with food.
He's really good at really lifting up what's available. He works with the farmers, knowing what's in season, working his menu around what's in the growth now, not trying to build his purveyors into his menu. And what's really cool, on his truck it says from roots to wheels, so mm-hmm. if it's in season and the farmer says it's ripe, that's what he's going to use. He's not going to ask for something away from it.
The guy has complete command and understanding of what is coming out of Ventura County and what time of the year to use it and how to use it, and you can't say that about a lot of chefs.
And it's a great tie-in, I think, Curtis, you would agree, going back to our conversation about ingredients and whatnot, though, it's a great tie-in to the Four Bricks philosophy as well, and a winemaker in general, of taking that harvest. What do I have available to me right now? I have one shot at it. I want to make it its best, bring out the flavors, and bring it to my customers. I think the partnership for First Friday is a natural thing.
Yeah, and we love it, and it's been successful. He was here. We kicked off First Friday last month, and he went through. He sold out in what he thought was going to be 4 hours. He was hoping he'd sell out. He sold out in less than an hour and a half. So
oh, nice.
Hopefully he's not bringing too much more food this week and thinking it's going to happen again. But, you know, I'll just have to be eating a lot of pork, peanut butter, and jelly sandwiches, I guess.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No.
So this beer here, it took me a
few. Did we have some?
It took me a few sips to get over the initial palate shock. And there's a little bit coming from the wine and going into this, but the spice that I'm getting from the yeast and certainly the raisins that kind of come as an ester, almost just kind of breathing it out is where I
well, the first thing I get is definitely Champenoise method. I mean, you could tell this is done by natural CO2, right? It's not been pumped in, so very creamy. Absolutely love that combination of kind of the bitter down the middle, and then I get this sweet from the raisin on the side. Mm-hmm. That just, wow, that's a great wine.
Yeah, there's a figgy, or a great molasses-y, beer, almost smokiness that's tied down in mm-hmm. there too.
So, you know, this time of year is the time that beer is mostly drank here in the winery. They'll tell you, you know, winemakers will say that it takes a lot of beer to make a little bit of wine. When we're back there working and sweating all day long, and Jace can be the first one to contest to that, the last thing we want to do is crack open a bottle of wine. We're drinking beer like crazy.
You want to do a nice crisp lager or pilsner to wash away the sweat and the heat.
You could almost get away with a Coors Light back there.
We'll strike that from the editing. That'll be on the cutting room floor later.
Yeah, almost.
That will not make it out. I would suggest possibly. No, but I...
We drink a lot of Surf's. I'll tell you. They're right up the street from us, and we drink a lot of Surf's Mondo back there.
Oh, the Mondo's Cream Ale. We've talked about that in Pints and Pairings. That thing is versatile with food and, again, very refreshing. So I'm glad to hear that you're endorsing the Mondo's Cream Ale.
Oh, yeah. We've got a few growlers back there ready to be filled up tomorrow.
Well, Gary, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for having us. I'm glad to come in here, and it's on a Thursday night where you weren't probably going to be here either.
No, I'm tomorrow morning off to Paso Robles to pick up Zinfandel, and we'll be bringing that in tomorrow evening. And actually, I'll hit that with a little CO2, and we'll crush that on Saturday morning, and then we'll be pressing off the Tempranillo back there on Sunday. So,
do you take pictures while you're doing that? Is there a webcam back there where we can watch people?
No, we should probably do something like that. But
be careful though, Gary. There's some things that happened in the cellar you don't want everyone knowing.
No, we've had some fun back there, and a couple oops of daisies.
Trade secrets, my friends.
Yeah. No, I'm an open book though. Anybody comes to me, I tell them what's going on. I have no problem with that. You know, that's one of the things that I find across all of the crafts, beer, wine, spirits, they're generally very approachable. You know, be it a cellar master, a brew master. I had people open up their closet to me and teach me how to do this, and the last thing I want to do is to hide a secret that I might have found out that has been, you know, passed down for five generations and it dies with me. It's not going to happen. I'll pass it down to somebody else, and I have no problem with that, because at the end of the day, I get to sit down with friends. I get to drink great beer, great wine, eat cheeses, and that's life. You know, without that, I don't know what you're going
to
do.
I think that's a great moment to cheers on. Segment and a good show tonight.
Cheers.
Nothing wrong with wrapping this one up on that, yeah?
I think so. I think it's as good a time as any.
And Joby Juan, we miss you.
There you go.
Take care, Joby.
We'll take that glycol fix.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll take one for me, and I'll take one for you over here.
Pour some out for the Joby. We hope your glycol issues have been resolved.
That's right.
Cheers, guys.
There's cream for that.
That's right. Okay, so let's close it up then. This has been Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. However, Jason's been sitting in all night, so it's been
Thanks
Happy Hour
me.
With Curtis and Jason. And we, thank you for coming in and certainly sitting in. That's why we call you around, because you never know. And hey, there you are.
That bat phone that we were talking about earlier. How can we find out? How can the listeners get back into the past episodes of Happy Hour?
All right. So then go to hopheadshead.com and click the Happy Hour link. It's at the top of the page, a menu drop down. Go to iTunes, Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis, Facebook, Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. Give us likes, rate us on iTunes, do all that stuff. Tell your friends about us. All that good stuff, and it'll just help us
instead of feedback
keep schmoozing people like Gary to let us come in on off nights and drink their wares.
And it is Happy Hour, which includes a whole spectrum of booze and adult beverages. So if you want something talked about, that maybe you haven't seen in the archives yet, send over a note to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis, and you can get that address at Curtis@hophead.com.
There you go. Thank you. Because I was coming up with some kind of smart ass comment for to say after something, and then you threw. Then I wasn't really paying attention. And then it came back at me. I'm like, what he said.
I like it.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Cheers.
Cheers.
Take care.
Hey, thanks for listening to Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. If you like this podcast, make sure you like us on iTunes. You can also find us on Facebook under Happy Hour with Joby and Curtis. Give us a like and share it with all your friends. We'd appreciate it. Cheers.